My name's Terry Gray, and I am the chair and of this session and the one in after the water symposium. And so these three sessions are the sort of more technical side of the conference, involving energy and water issues. Many of the speakers, of course, will touch on faith issues as well. But this has the more technical bent to it. And we welcome you. We didn't get a good start from our morning session. We're a little bit late. Apologize for that. And hopefully at some point we can make up some time. So Jack, you have to, you know, adjust just a little for me. And I need to find my talk. Okay, so this session is called Energy, Water, and Environment, and we have three speakers. I'm going to lead us off with kind of a big picture overview, and then we have John Turner talking about the hydrogen economy, and Richard Pasamenik talking about propellant fracturing. So sort of an update on the latest technologies in the fracking world. So, I'm a part-time instructor at a Colorado State University, and my background is as a biochemist and molecular biologist, but in recent years I've been doing teaching of a non-majors chemistry course that is kind of the inspiration for this talk. And teaching that course has gotten me into energy issues in a more professional way than I have been in the past. And I've been spending some time thinking and writing about those sorts of issues. So today, I thought it would be good to start us with some big picture and long range thinking. And you know, Catherine's talk just is the perfect intro to this. We're going to look at global energy demand for the year 2100. Okay, so most of us are thinking about 2020, 2025, 2035, maybe 2050. I'm going to try to get us to think about what we're going to need in 2100. And of course, there's a lot of risk associated with moving that far into the future. It seems like distant future, but you know, some of you have been around as long as I have, and longer. And I'm amazed that 1967 was only 50 years ago. That's just unbelievable to me. You know, there's a song that says "Don't blink," and you know that's my life. It seems so. Blink twice, and we're at 2100. Okay. Some might say it's useless to talk about 2100. Just think about what life was like in 1900 compared to today. Okay, here's a cityscape in New York in 1900. Bustling streets, probably wooden frame, three or four story buildings at the max. Horses on the street. Now there's another, that's not New York, but comparable modern city today. So I think a rough estimates approach, especially sort of the optimistic one that I'm going to present, although there's some pessimistic aspects of it, is worth contemplating. So there's no sense in too much detail, so back of the envelope is the way we're going to do this. Rough estimates with easy to calculate numbers is all we need to do. So, where are we today with some of the things we need to consider? Okay, I tapped into the pop clock here just a few days ago, so this is off by a little bit, but last week the U.S. population was 325 million, the world population 7.4 billion, and you know, this is just a real-time rough estimate calculator of the world's population. And just down at the bottom, you see there the two top most populous countries, China at 1.38 billion people, India 1.28 billion people. The United States is third at 325 million, but the EU, if we combine them together, it's 510 million, a half a billion people. The continent of Africa, I didn't put that on the slide, but 1.26 billion. So we'll think a little bit about where Africa is on all this as well. So that's population. And then energy use. So here's today's global energy use. Okay, and this data comes from the BP Statistical Review. They put their data in terms of millions of tons of oil equivalents, and I turn it into real science units. So the world uses 556 exajoules. That's 10 to the 18th joules. Exajoules is that's about a country size unit. We measure the units of energy use in countries with exajoules. If you're kind of in the American discussion of energy, we tend to use quads or quadrillion BTUs, and roughly an exajoule is equal to a quad. So here's the total energy use, 556. China is the top energy user in the world at 128 exajoules. US, 95, EU, 69, India, 30. And if we put Africa on the table, it's 18 exajoules, okay, the whole continent, okay? So, you know, usually at this point, we have this sort of observation to help Americans think about their blessings or think about the injustice of their wealth and riches. But the U.S., with 4.4% of the world's population, uses 17% of its energy resources. So from these numbers, we can calculate what's called a per capita energy use, how much energy is used per person in a country, divide the energy, that's the number on the left, by the population, and you get some number. I'm going to change units to gigajoules per person. Giga is 10 to the ninth. Okay, so it's just another SI prefix that most of you probably know. Just to help you sort of get a sense of this, 2 gigajoules is about the amount of heat produced or the energy released when you burn a tank of gasoline. Okay, so fill your car with gas, you get 2 gigajoules of heat out of it when we burn it over the course of the next couple weeks. And those are the numbers. The world average energy use is 75 gigajoules per person. US uses 292, EU 135, China 93, India 23, and the continent of Africa is 14. Yes?
Is that per year?
That's per year, yes, yes. These are per year numbers. So that's sort of, we have this discussion in the looking at energy and power. You know, do we measure power? Do we measure energy? Well, I like to report units in energy units, but technically they're power units because it's energy per year. But we're getting the average of the whole year's worth of energies. Okay, so this is just another way to note the inequity. Look how much energy the U.S. uses compared to other countries or compared to the world average. I'm going to say, and I hope I can get all the way through this because it. The conclusion is just the tail end of this whole line of reasoning. But 135, the European Union number, is probably a good ballpark number for a reasonably developed nation. And we are over double that. China and India and the world average are yet below those numbers. Okay, so One other thing we need to introduce is what's called the Human Development Index. This is those three bullets at the bottom there: life expectancy of birth, education, years of schooling, and per capita income. GDP divided by the population is the basis for this, and I don't want to go into all the details of this, but it's a way to assign a number between 0 and 1 to assess the development of a nation. And in our world, we have some numbers from about 0.4 to the least developed countries to almost 1, 0.9, 0.95 for the most developed countries. We typically will divide these up into quartiles, so very highly developed countries, less developed countries, and very low developed countries. And so darker blue is more developed. Just note there what countries, what parts of the world have dark blue, and those are the developed countries in the world. The light blue or almost white on this screen is the least developed, and you see that's largely clustered in Africa. So HDI may not be a perfect indicator of development, but it seems to be a reasonable one and good enough for our purposes. Top HDI countries, by the way, are Norway at 0.949, Australia 0.939, Switzerland 0.939, Germany 0.926. US is tied with Canada for 9th and 10th place at 9.92, okay? And so the lowest on the current list is 0.352, okay, the very low human development country. Okay, so the goal of development is to help nations increase their human development index, or at least, you know, that's the way we quantitate it. And most of us think that increased lifespan, less disease, more education, and the opportunities that flow from it, decent incomes are good things, okay? We do want to be careful about having sort of a Western exporting of values and things and, you know, sort of a new form of colonialism. But I think by and large, developed countries want to become more developed by these standards, and we desire that in terms of seeing to their well-being as well. So with the cautions about possibly being paternalistic and American-centric, Eurocentric, there's a sense in which everybody wants to be like Western Europeans and Americans with respect to some of these values. So just with that little social science caveat, there are many bad things about Western lifestyle we don't want to export. And some people don't always like the HDI, so there's an alternative happiness index that includes some of these factors, but other kinds of things that are a little less quantitative. All right, now if we plot the HDI here, okay, as a function of per capita energy use, so the two numbers that we just came up with, we get this figure. Okay, and this is a very interesting figure. There's a lot to talk about. There's a definite correlation between HDI and per capita energy use, at least until you get to the plateau at the top. Okay, notice there's a sharp increase as you go from just very, very low per capita energy to higher and higher. But once you get to about the 100, 150, there doesn't seem to be much improvement in development as recorded by HDI compared with per capita energy use. So correlation is not causation, of course. We want to always say that, but I think a strong case can be made that energy access indeed causes development and leads to development. And you know, Catherine talked a little bit about energy poverty. Lighting leads to the ability to read, study, do commerce into the night, enhancing education and business. Hans Rosling, a late World Health Organization official and Swedish statistician, showed in a dramatic way, and I'd encourage you to go look at his video about washing machines and development, that Getting a washing machine in the hands of the women enables them to learn how to read books. And he has this very cool thing when, at the end of the day, what comes out of the the clothes washer is books and education because of the time. Electricity allows for communication, other infrastructure developments to allow business to thrive, which drives up personal incomes. Okay, so we can get up to point 8.9 by increasing access to energy. Okay, now, just a comment about the ones to the right there. You see Trinidad and Tobago, Iceland, Qatar, Canada, U.S., UAE, and Saudi Arabia is out there too. These typically are high energy available countries. Okay, and so it's easy to waste, if you want to use that word, just because energy is so abundant. In Iceland, it's, you know, it's not easy to recapture the thermal, geothermal energy and export it to a poor country who needs more energy. Okay, and you know, there are similar things like that. So I'm not going to judge them too hard, but we can see that we don't need that much energy to maintain the lifestyle and level of development that we have. We could, in the U.S., let's just say as a case study, we could cut back from 292 to 150 using efficiency measures or conservation measures or alternatives that are easier and better to use, and maybe, in fact, send some of those energy resources, by the way, natural resources, to other countries. Okay, so let's quickly get into then the four assumptions and the conclusion I want to draw. From this chart here, I'm going to argue that let's shoot for 100 and let's see, what number did I end up using? 135 gigajoules per person as sort of the ideal good level. So if we can get the whole world at 135 by 2100, that's going to be our working assumption. And we'll have conquered poverty, we'll have conquered energy poverty. You know, there are other social ills, power struggles, warfare between religious groups and political and ethnic groups. But in terms of access to basic resources and education and so on, I don't think it's that unreasonable. Okay, so next we're going to talk about population. This is kind of maybe the big assumption of the day. What's the population in 2100? And I'm going to say, and go along with sort of some optimistic thinkers, that if development occurs on the schedule that I've suggested, and we can get everybody up to the 0.8, 0.9 HDI index, that's going to drive the population growth rate significantly down. Okay, and especially the education of women, providing reproductive options for women, reduces family size, and it's just very well documented. So I'm going to go with sort of these are some projections that the UN has made about population, and I'm going to go with kind of that somewhere between medium and low, and just give us a good back of the envelope 10 billion people. The Earth's population is going to stabilize out at 10 billion. Okay. So that's our starting point here. Now we can do our basic calculation, okay? And you know, don't let your eyes blur over because I'm doing these simple calculations. Back of the envelope, okay? So what's the global demand for 10 billion people where each person is using 135 gigajoules? Very simple calculation. Okay, and the answer is 1,350 exajoules. Okay, now this is roughly three times our current energy use. And As much as we talk about the need to get to clean energy, to get to efficient energy, to get rid of fossil fuels and get renewables on board, I think there's a lot, there seldom is mentioned that the demand is going to be this. Okay? Let's see. Let me jump to see if this movie plays. Okay, and I'm just going to, there's no audio for it. This is from Pandora's Promise, a video that highlights some pro-nuclear environmentalists. But Mike Schellenberger in this video is making the same point. Here's the Earth at Night video that we saw already, and each rotation is another roughly 50 years. And you see that as we move into the late, the 2050s, 2075, that more and more of the Earth is getting lit up at night. And just a very interesting pictorial representation of that demand. Okay, I'm running out of time. So I'm just going to mention this. The Water Symposium is coming up, and there's a water energy nexus that we need to worry about. And so I'm going to make the outrageous and outlandish proposal that all irrigation and domestic use of water in 2100 can come from desalination. Okay, so we're going to take ocean water and put even more energy at it and get the water we need to live. Okay, so if you do that, and here's the calculations, I end up with 122 exajoules in addition. Okay, so that's just under 10% of the total energy demand in 2100 to give us that extra little bit that a lot of people say is a problem if we keep making more and more energy. Okay, so anyway, the bottom line is this 1,472 exajoules. That's our energy need for the 2100. Okay, another one of my assumptions is that all of that energy by 2100 will have to be clean energy. Okay, no dispute with anything Catherine said this morning. We need to move away from fossil fuels. We probably even need to take some CO2 out of the atmosphere based on what we've done. So anyway, here's a list of sort of current carbon-free energy, and nuclear is on my list in addition to the traditional renewables. And I'm going to even say fossil fuels plus carbon capture, if we ever can work that out, is a possible solution. Okay, so if we look at how much clean energy we have today, it's 2,001 gigawatt carbon-free power plants. Okay, 2,001 gigawatt carbon-free power plants. So we need to do one last calculation. How much energy does a 1 gigawatt power plant produce in a year? Again, you can check my math here. There it is all worked out. But the bottom line, this number's, at least for me, has been very valuable in thinking about all this, so I've got this memorized. 0.0315 exajoules per year for a power plant. Okay? So if we take our 1,472 exajoules, divide by 0.0315, we're going to need 46,730 1-gigawatt power plants in 2100. Okay. So for good measure, let's subtract the 2,000 we already have. If we count up all the hydro plants and wind farms and solar farms and nuclear power plants, we get 44,000. We've got 83 years to get there, so let's, just assume we're going to be on a straight line trajectory there. 539 new 1 gigawatt clean energy power plants are needed every year for the next 83 years. Okay? to meet world energy demand in 2100. And, you know, let's put a price tag on that, $2 to $5 billion per power plant. You know, we can talk about that in discussion if there's interest. So, a few trillion dollars each year for the next 83 years. So that's 1 to 3% of the gross world product, all the domestic products of the nations. Okay, last year we built an equivalent of 73 1-gigawatt power plants out of the 539 we need every year. And, you know, we're patting ourselves on the back for our amazing progress in rolling out clean energy power plants or new nuclear power plants or whatever but it's nowhere near what we need to get to where we need to be to meet the world energy demand then in 2100. Okay, the end message is we better pick up the pace. And this talk is meant just to throw out this kind of, I don't think very much talked about urgency for our energy needs that needs to be considered alongside with all the issues of a good environmental approach to new energy and replacing fossil fuels. Okay, I'll stop there, and I don't know, we've got a few minutes maybe for questions. So, thank you. Yep.
If this is photovoltaic, say, is a major portion of this, that 2,000 gigajoule plants, how much land area is that going to take?
Right. So, I assign this problem for my students. We can actually build solar farms that take up 1/30th of the area of the state of Arizona and have enough solar power for the whole United States. Okay, there's a lot of space out there. Now, we may not want to convert that much desert southwest to a solar farm. And, there are, of course, issues with transmission and so on. People have done calculations, just what looks like a really tiny chunk of the Sahara Desert turned into a vast solar farm could provide this energy demand. Yep.
What if you comment on an article that came out in the Economist in last July 5th? It says it's called a green red herring, and it says the goal should be curb global warming, not achieve 100% renewable energy. And that article also says, after decades of investment, it's wrong to leave nuclear on the table. And let's face it, a lot of environmental organizations are dead set against nuclear.
Right. So I have nuclear on the table. I personally don't think we can do without it. We can't get there. We're talking about, can we do 100% renewables? But really, the people who are doing the calculations in a serious way are looking at 30, 40, 50% renewables, some dispatchable kind of. I mean, it's a complicated issue, but this Pandora's Promise video that I mentioned is some environmentalists who have changed their mind about nuclear and are now willing to consider it, even though many have not yet done that. So whether the U.S. will ever, or the world will ever, return to any kind of nuclear consideration, I don't know. Yep?
This idea that the United States only has 4% of people but uses like 20% of the energy doesn't mean we're energy hogs, because we're producing like 60% of global GDP. So we're using that energy to create a lot of good.
Oh, yeah. And you notice my trajectory here is, let's make everybody more like us. Now, I don't think we need to go whole hog and make everybody
use. A lot of energy is used to make food.
300. Yep.
Right,
yep. So, but Yeah, I take your point. Yep.
When you said 73 was the product this year of the number of plants, was that a net of 73, or did you?
What I did is I added together the capacity of all of the new power plants that are clean, so nuclear, renewables, and so on. And so it's not that there are 74 installations somewhere or 79. There's 79 equivalent 1 gigawatt power plants. And what? Just one caveat. If you might have seen it on the slide, I divide solar capacity by 4, and I divide wind capacity by 3, because the sun's not shining all the time, wind's not blowing all the time, and so. If those solutions are our solutions, and I think they need to be part of the mix, we have to get a comparable 1 gigawatt power plant, we actually need 4 1 gigawatt solar power plants.
What I was really getting at, though, was does the 73, is that a net of, do you also take into consideration the fossil fuel plants that have been decommissioned?
Those are just new additions.
Okay,
it's not net.
Off.
Right. I mean, if you follow my assumptions, all of the fossil fuel power plants are going to go away by 2100, or they'll be converted to carbon capture based systems. We probably need to get on to the next speaker. So, are we out of time, Jack? We need. Okay. So I'll moderate the others, but thank you. And next, thank you.